Snarlgly for Two. It was late afternoon when Aragorn opened his eyes. The blanket of clouds had broken in several places, and beams of golden light flanked the valley floor, illuminating the tops of the ruined buildings. Though the valley still looked cold and wet and unwelcoming, the light gave it a newfound majesty. For the first time, Aragorn understood why the riders had chosen to settle on the island. He yawned, and then glanced over at Saphira and lightly touched her mind. She was still asleep, lost in a dreamless slumber. Her consciousness was like a flame that had dimmed until it was little more than a smouldering coal, a coal that might just as easily go out as flare up again. The feeling unsettled him. It reminded him too much of death. So he returned to his own mind and restricted their contact to a narrow thread of thought, just enough so that he could be sure of her safety. In the forest behind him, a pair of squirrels began to swear at each other with a series of high-pitched shrieks. He frowned as he listened. Their voices sounded a bit too sharp, a bit too fast, a bit too warbly. It was as if some other creature was imitating the cries of the squirrels. The thought made his scalp prickle. He lay where he was for over an hour, listening to the shrieks and chattering that emanated from the woods, and watching the patterns of light as they played across the hills, fields, and mountains of the bowl-shaped valley. Then the gaps in the clouds closed, the sky darkened, and snow began to fall on the upper flanks of the mountains, painting them white. Aragorn rose and said to Gleda, "I'm going to gather some firewood. I'll be back in a few minutes." The dragon acknowledged him, and Aragorn carefully made his way across the meadow to the forest, doing his best to be quiet so as not to disturb Saphira. Once he was at the trees, he quickened his pace. Although there were plenty of dead branches along the verge of the forest, he wanted to stretch his legs and, if he could, find the source of the chattering. Shadows lay heavy under the trees. The air was cool and still, like that of a cave deep underground, and it smelled of fungus, rotting wood, and oozing sap. The moss and lichen that trailed from the branches were like lengths of tattered lace, stained and sodden, but still possessed of a certain delicate beauty. They partitioned the interior of the woods into cells of varying size, which made it difficult to see more than 50 feet in any direction. Aragorn used the burbling of the brook to determine his bearings as he worked his way deeper into the forest. Now that he was close to them, he saw that the evergreens were unlike those from the Spine or even from Duweldenvarden. They had clusters of 7 needles instead of 3, and though it might have been a trick of the fading light, it seemed to him as if darkness clung to the trees, like a cloak wrapped around their trunks and branches. Also, everything about the trees, from the cracks in the bark to their protruding roots to their scaled cones, everything about them had a peculiar angularity and a fierceness of line that made them appear as if they were about to pull themselves free of the earth and stride down to the city below. Aragorn shivered and loosened Brisinger in its scabbard. He had never before been in a forest that felt so menacing. It was as if the trees were angry. And as with the apple grove earlier, as if they wanted to reach out and rend his flesh from his bones. With the back of his hand, he brushed aside a swath of yellow lichen as he cautiously made his way forward. So far, he had seen no sign of game, nor had he found any evidence of wolves or bears, which puzzled him. That close to the stream, there should have been trails leading to the water. Maybe the animals avoid this part of the woods, he thought. But why? A fallen log lay across his path. He stepped over it, and his boot sank ankle-deep into a carpet of moss. An instant later, the Gedway Ignazia on his palm began to itch, and he heard a tiny chorus of "Skree, skree!" and "Skree, skra!" as a half-dozen white, worm-like grubs, each the size of one of his thumbs, burst out of the moss and began to hop away from him. Old instincts took hold, and he stopped, as he would if he had chanced upon a snake. He did not blink. He did not even breathe as he watched the fat, obscene-looking grubs flee. At the same time, he racked his memory for any mention of them during his training in Ellesmere, but he could recall no such thing. "Glader, what are these?" And he showed the dragon the grubs. "What is their name in the ancient language?" To Aragorn's dismay, Glader said,
"They are unknown to me. I have not seen their like before, nor have I heard tell of them. They are new to Vroengard and new to Alagazia. Do not let them touch you. They may be more dangerous than they appear."
Once they had put several feet between them and Aragorn, the nameless grubs hopped higher than usual, and with a scree-crow, dove back into the moss. As they landed, they split, dividing into a swarm of green centipedes, which quickly disappeared within the tangled strands of moss. Only then did Aragorn allow himself to breathe.
"They should not be," said Glader.
He sounded troubled. Aragorn slowly lifted his boot off the moss and retreated behind the log. Examining the moss with greater care, he saw that what he had originally taken as the tips of old branches poking out of the blanket of vegetation were actually pieces of broken ribs and antlers, the remains, he thought, of one or more deer. After a moment's consideration, Aragorn turned around and began to retrace his steps, this time making sure to avoid every scrap of moss along the way, which was no easy task. Whatever had been chattering in the forest was not worth risking his life to find, especially since he suspected that there was worse than the grubs lurking among the trees. His palm kept itching, and from experience he knew that meant there was still something dangerous close by. When he could see the meadow and the blue of Saphira's scales between the trunks of the evergreens, he turned aside and walked to the brook. Moss covered the bank of the stream, so he stepped from log to stone until he was standing on a flat-topped rock in the midst of the water. There he squatted, removed his gloves, and washed his hands, face, and neck. The touch of the icy water was bracing, and within moments his ears flushed and his whole body began to feel warm. A loud chattering rang forth over the stream as he wiped the last few droplets from his neck. Moving as little as possible, he looked toward the top of the trees on the opposite bank. 30 feet up, 4 shadows sat on a branch. The shadows had large barbed plumes that extended in every direction from the black ovals of their heads. A pair of white eyes, slanted and slit-like, glowed within the middle of each oval, and the blankness of their gaze made it impossible to determine where they were looking. Most disconcerting yet, the shadows, like all shadows, had no depth. When they turned to the side, they disappeared. Without taking his eyes off them, Aragorn reached across his body and grasped Brisinga's hilt. The leftmost shadow ruffled its plumes and then uttered the same shrieking chatter he had mistaken for a squirrel. 2 more of the wraiths did likewise, and the forest echoed with a strident clamour of their cries. Aragorn considered trying to touch their minds, but remembering the Fanghur on his way to Ellesmere, he discarded the idea as foolhardy. In a low voice, he said, "Eka e frike un shortugal." "I am a rider and a friend." The shadows seemed to fix their glowing eyes upon him, and for a moment all was silent, save the gentle murmuring of the brook. Then they began to chatter again, and their eyes increased in brightness until they were like pieces of white-hot iron. When after several minutes the shadows had made no move to attack him, and moreover showed no indication of departing, Aragorn rose to his feet and carefully reached out with 1 foot toward the stone behind him. The motion seemed to alarm the wraiths. They shrieked in unison. Then they shrugged and shook themselves, and in their place appeared 4 large owls with the same barbed plumes surrounding their mottled faces. They opened their yellow beaks and chattered at him, scolding him even as squirrels might. Then they took wing and flew silently off into the trees, and soon vanished behind a screen of heavy boughs.
"Barzul," said Aragorn.
He jumped back the way he had come and hurried to the meadow, stopping only to pick up an armful of fallen branches. As soon as he reached Sephira, he placed the wood on the ground, knelt, and began to cast wards, as many as he could think of. Gleda recommended a spell that he had overlooked, then said,
"None of these creatures were here when Oromes and I returned after the battle. They are not as they should be. The magic that was cast here has twisted the land and those who live on it. This is an evil place now."
"What creatures?"
asked Sephira. She opened her eyes and yawned, an intimidating sight. Aragorn shared his memories with her, and she said,
"You should have brought me with you. I could have eaten the grubs and the shadow birds, and then you would have had nothing to fear from them."
"Sephira." She rolled an eye at him.
"I'm hungry. Magic or not, is there any reason I should not eat these strange things?" "Because they might eat you instead, Sephira Bjartskula," said Gleda. "You know the first law of hunting as well as I. Do not stalk your prey until you are sure that it is prey. Otherwise you might well end up as a meal for something else."
"I wouldn't bother looking for deer either," said Aragorn. "I doubt there are many left. Besides, it's almost dark, and even if it weren't, I'm not sure hunting here would be safe." She growled softly,
"Very well. Then I shall keep sleeping. But in the morning, I shall hunt, no matter the danger. My belly is empty, and I must eat before crossing the sea again."
True to her word, Sephira closed her eyes and promptly returned to sleep. Aragorn built a small fire, then ate a meager supper, and watched the valley grow black. He and Gleda talked about their plans for the following day, and Gleda told him more about the history of the island, going back to the time before the elves had arrived in Alagazia, when Vroengard had been the province of the dragons alone. Before the last of the light had faded from the sky, the old dragon said,
"Would you like to see Vroengard as it was during the Age of the Riders?"
"I would," said Aragorn.
"Then look,"
said Gleda, and Aragorn felt the dragon take hold of his mind, and into it pour a stream of images and sensations. Aragorn's vision shifted, and atop the landscape he beheld a ghostly twin of the valley. The memory was of the valley in twilight, even as it was at the present. The sky was free of clouds, and a multitude of stars shone twinkling and gleaming over the great ring of fire mountains, Aras Thelduin. The trees of long ago appeared taller, straighter, and less foreboding, and throughout the valley the riders' buildings stood intact, glowing like pale beacons in the dusk with the soft light from the elves' flameless lanterns. Less ivy and moss covered the ochre stone then, and the halls and towers seemed noble in a way that the ruins did not. And along the cobblestone pathways and high overhead, Aragorn discerned the glittering shapes of numerous dragons, graceful giants with the treasure of 1,000 kings upon their hides. The apparition lasted for a moment longer, then Gleda released Aragorn's mind, and the valley once more appeared as it was.
"It was beautiful," said Aragorn.
"That it was, but no more."
Aragorn continued to study the valley, comparing it to what Gleda had shown him, and he frowned when he saw a line of bobbing lights, lanterns, he thought, within the abandoned city. He whispered a spell to sharpen his sight, and was able to make out a line of hooded figures in dark robes, walking slowly through the ruins. They seemed solemn and unearthly, and there was a ritualistic quality to the measured beats of their strides and to the patterned sway of their lanterns.
"Who are they?"
he asked Gleda. He felt as if he was witnessing something not meant for others to see.
"I do not know. Perhaps they are the descendants of those who hid during the battle, Perhaps they are men of your race who thought to settle here after the fall of the Riders. Or perhaps they are those who worship dragons and riders as gods.
Are there really such?
There were. We discouraged the practice, but even so, it was common in many of the more isolated parts of Alagesia. It is good, I think, that you placed the wards you did.
Aragorn watched as the hooded figures wound their way across the city, which took almost an hour. Once they arrived at the far side, the lanterns winked out one by one. And where the lantern holders had gone, Aragorn could not see, even with the assistance of magic. Then Aragorn banked the fire with handfuls of dirt and crawled under his blankets to rest.
Aragorn, Saphira, rouse yourselves!
Aragorn's eyes snapped open. He sat upright and grabbed Brisinga. All was dark, save for the dull red glow of the bed of coals to his right, and a ragged patch of starry sky off to the east. Though the light was faint, Aragorn was able to make out the general shape of the forest and the meadow, and the monstrously large snail that was sliding across the grass toward him. Aragorn yelped and scrambled backward. The snail, whose shell was over 5.5 feet tall, hesitated, then slimed toward him as fast as a man could run. A snake-like hiss came from the black slit of its mouth, and its waving eyeballs were each the size of his fist. Aragorn realized that he would not have time to get to his feet, and on his back he did not have the space he needed to draw Brisinga. He prepared to cast a spell, but before he could, Saphira's head arrowed past him, and she caught the snail about the middle with her jaws. The snail's shell cracked between her fangs with a sound like breaking slate, and the creature uttered a faint, quavering shriek. With a twist of her neck, Saphira tossed the snail into the air, opened her mouth as wide as it would go, and swallowed the creature whole, bobbing her head twice as she did, like a robin eating an earthworm. Lowering his gaze, Aragorn saw four more giant snails farther down upon the rise. One of the creatures had retreated within its shell. The others were hurrying away upon their undulating skirt-like bellies.
"Over there!"
shouted Aragorn. Saphira leaped forward. Her entire body left the ground for a moment, and then she landed upon all fours and snapped up first one, then two, then three of the snails. She did not eat the last snail, the one hiding in its shell, but drew back her head and bathed it in a stream of blue and yellow flame that lit up the land for hundreds of feet in every direction. She maintained the flame for no more than a second or two. Then she picked up the smoking, steaming snail between her jaws as gently as a mother cat picking up a kitten, carried it over to Aragorn, and dropped it at his feet. He eyed it with distrust, but it appeared well and truly dead.
"Now you can have a proper breakfast,"
said Saphira. He stared at her, then began to laugh, and he kept laughing until he was doubled over, resting his hands on his knees and heaving for breath.
"What is so amusing?"
she asked, and sniffed the soot-blackened shell.
"Yes, why do you laugh, Aragorn?"
asked Glaedah. He shook his head and continued to wheeze. At last he was able to say,
"Because,"
and then he shifted to speaking with his mind so that Glaedah would hear as well.
"Because snails and eggs,"
and he began to giggle again, feeling very silly.
"Because snail steaks. Hungry? Have a stalk. Feeling tired? Eat an eyeball. Who needs mead when you have slime? I could put the stalks in a cup like a bunch of flowers, and they would..."
He was laughing so hard he found it impossible to continue, and he dropped to one knee while he gasped for air, tears of mirth streaming from his eyes. Saphira parted her jaws in a toothy approximation of a smile, and she made a soft choking sound in her throat.
"You are very odd sometimes, Aragorn."
He could feel his merriment infecting her. She sniffed the shell again.
"Some mead would be nice."
"At least you ate," he said,
both with his mind and his tongue.
Not enough, but enough to return to the Varden.
As his laughter subsided, Aragorn poked at the snail with the tip of his boot. It's been so long since there were dragons on Vroengard, it must not have realized what you were, and thought to make an easy meal of me. That would have been a sorry death indeed, to end up as dinner for a snail.
But memorable,
said Saphira.
But memorable,
he agreed, feeling his mirth return.
And what did I say is the first law of hunting, younglings?
Asked Glada. Together, Aragorn and Saphira replied,
Do not stalk your prey until you are sure that it is prey.
Very good,
said Glada. Then Aragorn said, Hopping grubs, shadow birds, and now giant snails. How could the spells cast within the battle have created them?
The riders, the dragons, and the Forsworn loosed an enormous amount of energy during the conflict. Much of it was bound in spells, but much of it was not. Those who lived to tell of it said that for a time the world went mad, and nothing they saw or heard could be trusted. Some of that energy must have settled on the ancestors of the grubs and the birds you saw today, and altered them. However, you are mistaken to include the snails among their ranks. The Snarlgli, as they are known, have always lived here on Vroengard. They were a favorite food of ours, of the dragons, for reasons I'm sure, Saphira, you understand.
She hummed and licked her chops.
And not only is their flesh soft and tasty, but the shells are good for the digestion.
If they're just ordinary animals, then why didn't my ward stop them?
Asked Aragorn. At the very least, I should have been warned of approaching danger.
That, replied Glada, may be a result of the battle. Magic did not create the Snarlgli. But that does not mean they have remained unaffected by the forces that have racked this place. We should not linger here any longer than necessary. Better we leave before whatever else is lurking on the island decides to test our mettle.
With Saphira's help, Aragorn cracked open the shell of the burnt snail, and by the glow of a red weirlight, cleaned the spineless carcass within, which was a messy, slimy exercise that left him covered in gore up to his elbows. Then Aragorn had Saphira bury the meat close to the bed of coals. Afterward, Saphira returned to the spot in the grass where she had been lying, curled up once again, and went to sleep. This time, Aragorn joined her. Carrying his blankets and the saddlebags, one of which contained Glada's Heart of Hearts, he crawled under her wing and settled in the warm, dark nook between her neck and her body. And there he spent the rest of the night, thinking and dreaming. The following day was as grey and gloomy as the previous one. A light dusting of snow covered the sides of the mountains and the tops of the foothills, and the air had a chill that led Aragorn to believe it would snow again later that day. Tired as she was, Saphira did not stir until the sun was already a hand's breadth above the mountains. Aragorn was impatient, but he let her sleep. It was more important for her to recover from the flight to Vroengard than for them to get an early start. Once she was awake, Saphira dug up the snail carcass for him, and he cooked a large breakfast of snail. He was not sure what to call it. Snail bacon? Whatever the name for it, the strips of meat were delicious, and he ate more than he usually would. Saphira devoured what was left, and then they waited an hour, for it would not be wise to enter a fight with food in their stomachs. Finally, Aragorn rolled up his blankets and strapped the saddle back onto Saphira, and together with Glada, they set off for the Rock of Cuthien. The Rock of Cuthien. The walk to the apple grove seemed shorter than it had the previous day. The gnarled trees were as ominous as ever, and Aragorn kept his hand on Brisinga the whole time they were in the thicket. As before, he and Saphira stopped at the edge of the tangled clearing that fronted the Rock of Cuthien. A flock of crows was perched upon the rough crag of stone, and at the sight of Saphira they rose cawing into the air, as ill an omen as Aragorn could imagine. For half an hour, Aragorn stood fixed in place as he cast spell after spell, searching for any magic that could cause him, Saphira, or Gleyda harm. Woven throughout the clearing, the Rock of Cuthien, and so far as he could tell, the rest of the island, he found a daunting array of enchantments. Some of the spells embedded in the depths of the earth had such power that it felt as if a great river of energy was flowing beneath his feet. Others were small and seemingly innocuous, sometimes affecting only a single flower or a single branch of a tree. More than half of the enchantments were dormant, because they lacked energy, no longer had an object upon which to act, or were waiting for a certain set of circumstances that had yet to arrive. And a number of the spells seemed to conflict, as if the riders, or whoever had cast them, had sought to modify or negate earlier pieces of magic. Aragorn was unable to determine the purpose of most of the spells. No record remained of the words used to cast them, only the structures of energy that the long-dead magicians had so carefully created. And those structures were difficult, if not impossible, to interpret. Gleyda was of some help, as he was familiar with many of the older, larger pieces of magic that had been placed on Vroengard. But otherwise, Aragorn was forced to guess. Fortunately, even though he could not always figure out what a spell was supposed to do, he was often able to establish whether it would affect him, Saphira, or Gleyda. It was a complicated process that required complicated incantations, though, and it took him another hour to examine all the spells. What most worried him, and Gleyda as well, were the spells that they might not have been able to detect. Ferreting out other magicians' enchantments grew vastly more difficult if they had tried to hide their work. At last, when Aragorn was as confident as he could be that there were no traps on or around the Rock of Cuthien, he and Saphira walked across the clearing to the base of the jagged, lichen-covered spire. Aragorn tilted his head back and looked toward the top of the formation. It seemed incredibly far away. He saw nothing unusual about the stone, nor did Saphira.
"Let us say our names and be done with it," she said.
Aragorn sent a questioning thought to Gleyda, and the dragon responded,
"She is right. There is no reason to delay. Speak your name, and Saphira and I shall do likewise."
Feeling nervous, Aragorn clenched his hands twice, then unslung his shield from his back, drew Brisinga, and dropped into a crouch. "My name," he said in a loud, clear voice, "is Aragorn Shadeslayer, son of Brom."
"My name is Saphira Bjartskula, daughter of Vavada." "And mine, Gleyda Eldunari, son of Nithring, she of the long tail."
They waited. Off in the distance, the crows cawed as if mocking them. Unease stirred within Aragorn, but he ignored it. He had not really expected opening the vault to be quite so simple.
"Try again, but this time say your piece in the ancient language," advised Gleyda.
So Aragorn said, "Nam iet Aragorn Sundavar Vergandi, sonor Aber Brom." And then Saphira repeated her name and lineage in the ancient language, as did Gleyda. Again, nothing happened. Aragorn's unease deepened. If their trip had been in vain... No, it did not bear thinking about, not yet. "Maybe all of our names have to be uttered out loud," he said.
"How?"
asked Saphira.
"Am I supposed to roar at the stone? And what of Gleyda?"
"I can say your names for you," said Aragorn.
"It seems unlikely that is what is required, but we may as well attempt it," said Gleyda.
"In this or the ancient language?"
"The ancient language, I would think, but try both to be certain."
Two times, then, Aragorn recited their names, yet the stone remained as stolid and unchanging as ever. Finally, frustrated, he said, "Maybe we're in the wrong place. Maybe the entrance to the Vault of Souls is on the other side of the stone. Or maybe it's on the very top."
"If that were the case, wouldn't the directions contained within Domia Aba Weirda have mentioned it?"
asked Glader. Aragorn lowered his shield. "When are riddles ever easy to understand?"
"What if you are only supposed to give your name?"
Saphira said to Aragorn.
"Did not Solombum say, when all seems lost and your power is insufficient, go to the Rock of Cuthien and speak your name to open the Vault of Souls? Your name, Aragorn, not mine or Glader's."
Aragorn frowned. "It's possible, I suppose. But if only my name is needed, then perhaps I have to be by myself when I say it." With a growl, Saphira leaped into the air, ruffling Aragorn's hair and battering the plants in the clearing with the wind from her wings.
"Then try and be quick about it,"
she said as she flew east, away from the rock. When she was a quarter mile away, Aragorn looked back at the uneven surface of the rock, once more raised his shield, and once more pronounced his name, first in his own tongue and then in that of the elves. No door or passageway revealed itself. No cracks or fissures appeared within the stone. No symbols traced themselves upon its surface. In every respect, the towering spire seemed to be nothing more than a solid piece of granite, devoid of any secrets. "Saphira!" Aragorn shouted with his mind. Then he swore and stalked back and forth within the clearing, kicking at loose stones and branches. He returned to the base of the rock as Saphira swooped down to the clearing. The talons on her hind legs cut deep gouges in the soft earth as she landed, back flapping to slow herself to a halt. Leaves and blades of grass swirled about her as if caught in a whirlwind. Once she had dropped to all fours and folded her wings, Glader said,
"I take it you did not meet with success."
"No," snapped Aragorn, and he glared at the spire. The old dragon seemed to sigh.
"I was afraid this would be the case. There is only one explanation."
"That Solombum lied to us? That he sent us off on a wild chase so that Galbatorix could destroy the Varden while we're gone?"
"No. That in order to open this Vault of Souls," said Saphira. "Yes, this vault he told you about. That in order to open it, we must speak our true names."
The words fell between them like weighty stones. For a time, none of them spoke. The thought intimidated Aragorn, and he was reluctant to address it, as if doing so would somehow make the situation worse.
"But if it's a trap,"
said Saphira.
"Then it is a most devilish trap,"
said Glader.
"The question you must decide is this. Do you trust Solombum? For to proceed is to risk more than our lives. It is to risk our freedom. If you do trust him, can you be honest enough with yourselves to discover your true names? And quickly, too. And are you willing to live with that knowledge, however unpleasant it might be? Because if not, then we should leave this very moment. I have changed since Oromis's death, but I know who I am. But do you, Saphira, do you, Aragorn, can you really tell me what it is that makes you the dragon and rider you are?"
Dismay crept through Aragorn as he gazed up at the Rock of Cuthien. "Who am I?" he wondered. And all the world a dream. Nasawada laughed as the starry sky spun around her and she fell tumbling toward a crevice of brilliant white light miles below. Wind tore at her hair, and her shift flapped wildly, the ragged ends of the sleeves snapping like whips. Great big bats, black and dripping, flocked about her, nipping at her wounds with teeth that cut and stabbed and burned like ice. And still she laughed. The crevice widened, and the light engulfed her, blinding her for a minute. When her eyes cleared, she found herself standing in the hall of the soothsayer, looking at herself, lying strapped to the ash-coloured slab. Next to her limp body stood Galbatorix, tall, broad-shouldered, with a shadow where his face ought to be, and a crown of crimson fire upon his head. He turned toward where she was standing, and extended a gloved hand.
"Come, Nasuada, daughter of Arjahad, unbend your pride and pledge your fealty to me, and I shall give you everything you have ever wanted."
She uttered a derisive noise and lunged toward him with her hands outstretched. Before she could tear out his throat, the king vanished in a cloud of black mist.
"What I want is to kill you!"
she shouted toward the ceiling. The chamber rang with Galbatorix's voice as it emanated from every direction at once.
"Then here you shall stay until you realize the error of your ways."
Nasuada opened her eyes. She was still on the slab, her wrists and ankles chained down, and the wounds from the burrow grub throbbing as if they had never stopped. She frowned. Had she been unconscious, or had she just been talking with the king? It was so difficult to tell when, in one corner of the chamber, she saw the tip of a thick green vine force its way between the painted tiles, cracking them. More vines appeared next to the first. They poked through the wall from the outside and spread across the floor, covering it in a sea of writhing, snake-like appendages. Watching them crawl toward her, Nasuada began to chuckle. "Is this all he can think of? I have stranger dreams nearly every night." As if in response to her scorn, the slab beneath her melted into the floor, and the thrashing tendrils closed over her, wrapping around her limbs and holding them more securely than any chains. Her sight grew dark as the vines atop her multiplied, and the only thing she could hear was the sound of them sliding against one another, a dry, shifting sound, like that of falling sand. The air around her grew thick and hot, and she felt as if she was having trouble breathing. Had she not known that the vines were only an illusion, she might have panicked then. Instead, she spat into the darkness and cursed Galbatorix's name. Not for the first time, nor for the last, she was sure. But she refused to allow him the pleasure of knowing he had unbalanced her. Light, golden sunbeams, streaming across a series of rolling hills, patched with fields and vineyards. She was standing by the edge of a small courtyard, underneath a trellis laden with blooming morning glories, the vines of which seemed uncomfortably familiar. She was wearing a beautiful yellow dress. There was a crystal goblet of wine in her right hand, and the musky cherry taste of wine upon her tongue. A slight breeze was blowing from the west. The air smelled of warmth and comfort and freshly tilled land.
"Ah, there you are,"
said a voice behind her, and she turned to see Murtagh striding toward her from a grand estate. Like her, he held a goblet of wine. He was dressed in black hose and a doublet of maroon satin trimmed with gold piping. A gem-encrusted dagger hung from his studded belt. His hair was longer than she remembered, and he appeared relaxed and confident in a way she had not seen before. That, and the light upon his face, made him appear strikingly handsome, noble even. He joined her under the trellis and placed a hand on her bare arm. The gesture seemed casual and intimate.
"You minx, abandoning me to Lord Pharos and his interminable stories. It took me half an hour to escape."
Then he paused and looked at her closer, and his expression became one of concern. "Are you feeling ill? Your cheeks look grey." She opened her mouth, but no words came to her. She could not think how to react. Murtagh's brow furrowed. "You had another one of your attacks, didn't you?"
I don't know. I can't remember how I got here, or..."
She trailed off as she saw the pain that appeared in Murtagh's eyes, and which he quickly hid. He slid his hand down to the small of her back as he moved around her to stare out at the hilly landscape. With a swift motion, he drained his goblet. Then in a low voice, he said, "I know how confusing this is for you. It isn't the first time this has happened, but..."
He took a deep breath and shook his head slightly. "What is the last thing you remember? Tirm? Aberon? The Siege of Cythri? The gift I gave you that night in Aeam?" A terrible sense of uncertainty overcame her.
"Urobane," she whispered, "the Hall of the Soothsayer. That is my last memory."
For an instant, she felt his hand tremble against her back, but his face betrayed no reaction.
"Urobane,"
he repeated hoarsely. He looked at her.
"Nasawada, it's been 8 years since Urobane." "No," she thought, "it can't be. It can't be." And yet everything she saw and felt seemed so real. The motion of Murtagh's hair as the wind tousled it, the scent of the fields, the touch of her dress against her skin, it all seemed exactly as it should. But if she was actually there, then why hadn't Murtagh reassured her of it by reaching out to her mind as he had done before? Had he forgotten? If 8 years had elapsed, he might not remember the promise he made to her so long ago in the Hall of the Soothsayer.
"I..."
she started to say, and then she heard a woman call out,
"My lady!"
She looked over her shoulder and saw a portly maid hurrying down from the estate, the front of her white apron flapping.
"My lady," said the maid, and curtsied, "I'm sorry to disturb you, but the children hoped that you would watch them put on their play for the guests."
"Children?" she whispered.
She looked back at Murtagh, to see his eyes shining with tears.
"Aye," he said, "children. 4 of them, all strong and healthy, and full of high spirits."
She shuddered, overcome with emotion. She could not help it. Then she lifted her chin.
"Show me what I have forgotten. Show me why I have forgotten."
Murtagh smiled at her with what seemed like pride.
"It would be my pleasure," he said, and kissed her on the forehead.
He took her goblet and gave both glasses to the maid. Then he grasped her hands in his, closed his eyes, and bowed his head. An instant later, she felt a presence pressing against her mind, and then she knew. It was not him. It could never have been him. Angered by the deception and by the loss of what could never be, she pulled her right hand free of Murtagh's, grabbed his dagger, and shoved the blade into his side. And she shouted,
"In El Harim there lived a man with yellow eyes. To me he said, 'Beware the whispers, for they whisper lies.'"
Murtagh regarded her with a curiously blank expression, and then he faded away before her. Everything around her, the trellis, the courtyard, the estate, the hills with the vineyards, vanished, and she found herself floating in a void without light or sound. She tried to continue her litany, but no sound came from her throat. She could not even hear the pounding of her pulse in her veins. Then she felt the darkness twist, and... she stumbled and fell onto her hands and knees. Sharp rocks scraped her palms. Blinking as her eyes adjusted to the light, she rose to her feet and looked around. Ribbons of smoke drifting across a barren field similar to the burning plains. She was once more clothed in her tattered shift, and her feet were bare. Something roared behind her, and she spun around to see a 12-foot-tall cull charging toward her,
swinging an iron-bound club as large as she was. Another roar came from her left, and she saw a second cull, as well as four smaller Urgals. Then a pair of cloaked, hunchbacked figures scurried out of the whitish haze and darted in her direction, chittering and waving their leaf-bladed swords. Although she had never seen them before, she knew they were the Razak. She laughed again. Now Galbatorix was just trying to punish her. Ignoring the oncoming enemies, whom she knew she would never be able to kill or escape, she sat cross-legged on the ground and began to hum an old dwarvish tune. Galbatorix's initial attempts to deceive her had been subtle affairs that might very well have succeeded in leading her astray had Murtagh not warned her beforehand. To keep Murtagh's help a secret, she had pretended to be ignorant of the fact that Galbatorix was manipulating her perception of reality. But regardless of what she saw or felt, she refused to allow the king to trick her into thinking of the thing she should not, or far worse, giving him her loyalty. Defying him had not always been easy, but she held to her rituals of thought and speech, and with them she had been able to thwart the king. The first illusion had been of another woman, Rialla, who joined her in the hall of the soothsayer as a fellow prisoner. The woman claimed she was secretly wedded to one of the Varden's spies in Urubane, and that she had been captured while carrying a message for him. Over what seemed like the course of a week, Rialla tried to ingratiate herself with Nessawada, and in a sideways manner, convince her that the Varden's campaign was doomed, that their reasons for fighting were flawed, and that it was only right and proper to submit to Galbatorix's authority. In the beginning, Nessawada had not realized that Rialla herself was an illusion. She assumed that Galbatorix was distorting the woman's words or appearance, or perhaps that he was tampering with her own emotions to make her more susceptible to Rialla's arguments. As the days had dragged on, and Murtagh neither visited nor contacted her, she had grown to fear that he had abandoned her to Galbatorix's clutches. The thought caused her more anguish than she would have liked to admit, and she found herself worrying about it at nearly every turn. Then she had begun to wonder why Galbatorix had not come to torture her during the week. And it occurred to her that if a week had elapsed, then the Varden and the elves would have attacked Urubane. And if that had happened, Galbatorix surely would have mentioned it, if only to gloat. Moreover, Rialla's somewhat odd behaviour, combined with a number of inexplicable gaps in her memory, Galbatorix's forbearance, and Murtagh's continued silence, for she could not bring herself to believe that he would break his word to her, convinced her, as outlandish as it seemed, that Rialla was an apparition, and that time was no longer what it seemed. It had shaken her to realize that Galbatorix could alter the number of days she thought had passed. She loathed the idea. Her sense of time had grown vague during her imprisonment, but she had retained a general awareness of its passage. To lose that, to become unmoored in time, meant she was even more at Galbatorix's mercy, for he could prolong or contract her experiences as he saw fit. Still, she remained determined to resist Galbatorix's attempts at coercion, no matter how much time seemed to go by. If she had to endure 100 years in her cell, then 100 years she would endure, when she had proven immune to Rialla's insidious whisperings, and indeed finally denounced the woman for being a coward and a traitor. The figment was taken from her chamber, and Galbatorix moved on to another ploy. Thereafter his deceptions had grown increasingly elaborate and improbable, but none broke the laws of reason, and none conflicted with what he had already shown her, for the king was still trying to keep her ignorant of his meddling. His efforts culminated when he seemed to take her from the chamber to a dungeon cell elsewhere in the citadel, where she saw what appeared to be Aragorn and Saphira bound in chains. Galbatorix had threatened to kill Aragorn unless she swore fealty to him, the king. When she refused, much to Galbatorix's displeasure, and, she thought, his surprise, Aragorn shouted a spell that somehow freed the three of them. After a brief duel, Galbatorix fled, which he doubted he ever would do in reality,
and then she, Aragorn and Saphira started to fight their way out of the citadel. It had been rather dashing and exciting, and she had been tempted to find out how the sequence of events would resolve itself. But by then she felt she had played along with Galbatorix's false show for long enough. So she seized upon the first discrepancy she noticed, the shape of the scales around Saphira's eyes, and used it as an excuse to feign a realization that the world around her was only a pretense.
"You promised you would not lie to me while I was in the hall of the soothsayer," she had shouted into the air. "What is this but a lie, oathbreaker?"
Galbatorix's wrath at her discovery had been prodigious. She had heard a growl like that of a mountain-sized dragon, and then he abandoned all subtlety, and for the rest of the session he subjected her to a series of fantastical torments. At last, the apparitions had ceased, and Murtagh had contacted her to let her know she could once again trust her senses. She had never been so happy to feel the touch of his mind. That night he had come to her, and they spent hours sitting together and talking. He told her of the Vardens' progress, they were nearly upon the capital, and of the Empire's preparations, and he explained that he believed he had discovered a means of freeing her. When she pressed him for details, he refused to elaborate, saying, "I need another day or two to see if it will work. But there is a way, Nasawada. Take heart in that." She had taken heart in his earnestness and his concern for her. Even if she never escaped, she was glad to know that she was not alone in her captivity. After she recounted some of the things Galbatorix had done to her, and the means by which she had foiled him, Murtagh chuckled. "You've proven more of a challenge than he anticipated. It's been a long time since anyone has given him this much of a fight. I certainly didn't. I understand little about it, but I know it's incredibly difficult to create believable illusions. Any competent magician can make it seem as if you're floating in the sky, or that you're cold or hot, or that there's a flower growing in front of you. Small, complicated things, or large, simple things, are the most any one person can hope to create, and it requires a great deal of concentration to maintain the illusion. If your attention wavers, all of a sudden the flower has 4 petals instead of 10, or it might vanish altogether. Details are the hardest thing to replicate. Nature is filled with infinite details, but our minds can only hold so much. If you're ever in doubt as to whether what you're seeing is real, look at the details. Look for the seams in the world, where the spellcaster either does not know or has forgotten what should be there, or has taken a shortcut to conserve energy. If it's so difficult, then how does Galbatorix manage it? He's using the Eldonari. All of them? Murtagh nodded. They provide the energy and the details needed, and he directs them as he wants. So then, the things I see are built on the memories of dragons? She asked, feeling slightly awed. He nodded again. That and the memories of their riders, for those who had riders. The following morning, Murtagh had woken her with a swift bolt of thought to tell her that Galbatorix was about to start again. Thereafter, phantoms and illusions of every sort had beset her, but as the day wore on, she noticed that the visions, with a few notable exceptions, such as that of her and Murtagh at the estate, had grown increasingly fuzzy and simple, as if either Galbatorix or the Eldunari were growing tired. And now she sat upon the barren plain, humming a dwarven tune, as Kull, Urgles and Razak bore down on her. They caught her, and it felt as if they beat and cut her, and at times she screamed and wished her pain would end. But not once did she consider giving in to Galbatorix's desires. Then the plane vanished, as did most of her suffering, and she reminded herself, "It is only in my mind. I shall not give in. I am not an animal. I am stronger than the weakness of my flesh." A dark cave, lit by glowing green mushrooms, appeared around her. For several minutes, she heard a large creature snuffling and padding about, in the shadows between the stalagmites, and then she felt the creature's warm breath against the back of her neck, and she smelled the odour of carrion. She started to laugh again, and she continued to laugh, even as Galbatorix forced her to confront horror after horror in an attempt to find the particular combination of pain and fear that would break her. She laughed because she knew her will was stronger than his imagination, and she laughed because she knew she could count on Murtagh's help. And with him as her ally, she did not fear the spectral nightmares Galbatorix inflicted upon her, no matter how terrible they seemed at the time.